talking about failed health policies and colonial legacies, specifically looking at U.S. global HIV/AIDS policy and the vulnerability of sub-Saharan African women, using Kenya as a case study. So this study had three objectives. The first was to determine the extent and manner in which PEPFAR, the President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief, addresses the HIV infection risk of women. The second was to understand the historical processes that underlie contemporary Kenyan women's vulnerability to HIV infection. And the third objective was to identify the contemporary structural factors that perpetuate these historical processes today. So before we get started, I just wanted to give you a little bit of background information on HIV/AIDS in Kenya as well as PEPFAR. So of the 35 million people who currently reside in Kenya, 1.3 million are infected with HIV, two-thirds of which are women. In 2003, the HIV prevalence rate for women was considerably higher than that of men, as in many other parts of the world, 8.7% versus 4.5%. Young women are especially vulnerable to infection, and as a group, have a prevalence rate between 12.4% and 18.7%. So PEPFAR, which is the United States' main HIV global AIDS policy, was authorized in 2003 by the United States Leadership Against HIV/AIDS, TB, and Malaria Act, also known as H.R. 1298 for the policy people in the room. PEPFAR has three main objectives. The first is to provide ART to 2 million people. The second is to prevent 7 million new cases of HIV. And the third is to provide care to 10 million orphans and infected people. The goal was to disperse $15 billion to 15 of the most affected countries, including Kenya, between 2003 and 2008. So for this study, I used a qualitative approach that relied on policy, public health, and social science research, as well as policy analysis of H.R. 1298. So as you may remember, the first objective of the study was to assess how PEPFAR addresses the HIV infection risk of women. It basically does so through two main models. The first is the biomedical model, and the second is the cultural model. The biomedical model relies on clinical medicine and treatment, rather than public health and prevention, and is present throughout the bill. So for example, the bill proposes a series of interventions that center on the healthcare system and narrowly rely on clinical medicine and pharmaceutical drugs. It also prioritizes high-risk groups, such as commercial sex workers and injection drug users, to the detriment of the general population. Women, specifically, are constructed as reservoirs and vectors of HIV to both men and children by the bill's emphasis on sex work and maternal-to-child transmission. Lastly, there is a blatant lack of attention to the social context of HIV infection and transmission. The second model present in the bill is the cultural model, which doesn't do much better at addressing women's HIV infection risk. It narrowly focuses on quote-unquote traditional cultural practices, such as wife inheritance, polygamy, and child marriage, which are emphasized throughout the bill. And as Paul Farmer has pointed out many times, the cultural model of HIV/AIDS often relies on unproven theories that assume a causal relationship between traditional cultural practices and HIV infection without any formal epidemiological evidence. These theories often rely on cultural overgeneralizations and dismiss, just like the biomedical model, the socioeconomic context of people's lives. So instead of relying on these restrictive and in many regards deficient models, I will discuss women's HIV infection risk using the social production of disease model, which many of you may be familiar with, as it's been outlined by Nancy Krieger and others. And at the center of this model, as you can see, are social and economic and political factors. There are many variations to this model, but I will use the version presented here. Okay, so looking way upstream in the model at the historical processes, I first looked at the effects of British colonial rule in Kenya. I found that prior to colonialism, Kenya was an agrarian society that relied on extended familial networks. Land and other means of production were collectively owned, and the gender division of labor was fluid. I also found that there were parallel male and female leadership structures. Lastly, although women did have unequal access to land, property, and cattle compared to men, they did have considerable power in agriculture and sustenance. Kenya became a formal British colony in 1920. And for the purposes of this presentation, I will focus on only three of the effects that British colonialism had in Kenya. The first is that it transformed familial relations from extended networks to male-headed nuclear family units. The second is that although gender inequality had been present in Kenya prior to colonial rule, as we saw, colonialism formally and legally institutionalized gender inequality in Kenyan society. Third, British colonists assigned men individual rather than collective ownership rights over property. So how did British colonial rule affect gender relations in Kenya? Well, it did so through four major mechanisms. The first is colonial law, which reinforced customs that discriminated against women while dismissing those that provided rights to women. The second is colonial agricultural reform, which excluded women from some of the more lucrative agricultural activities such as cash crops. The third is land redistribution, which assigned individual men control over land. And last but not least is labor migration, which formally excluded women into about the 1960s and greatly altered gender relations in both urban and rural areas. So as you know, the past greatly informs the present. As a result, we can see many parallels between the position of Kenyan women during the colonial era and the present situation of Kenyan women. After colonial rule, the integration of women into the formal economy adhered to the strict gender division of labor that was established during the colonial era. As a result, the employment options of contemporary Kenyan women today are often limited to unregulated industries with low pay and few benefits. Also, girls and young women were formally excluded from schools during the colonial era. Today, we see that girls and young women continue to face significant access barriers to the education system, including sexual violence, school fees, and poverty. During the colonial era, many women's rights were undermined by discriminatory legal codes. Today, women continue to face barriers to accessing property, cattle, land, and health services as a result of laws that often require them to get their husband's permission to access these assets and benefits. So now that we've looked at history, what does this mean for the HIV infection risk of Kenyan women today? So basically, as many of you know, women that live in poverty and precarious economic positions are much more likely to engage in transactional sex, both formally and informally, in order to meet their economic needs, which therefore increases their vulnerability to HIV. Young women's restricted access to the education system means that they don't fully benefit from its preventative value, including things like social and economic skills, communication skills, and beneficial social networks. Lastly, the limited rights of women under Kenya's legal codes increases their risk of HIV infection by limiting their access to health services, land, property, and legal protection against rape and other forms of sexual violence, all of which are known risk factors for HIV/AIDS. So in summary, we saw that U.S. global HIV/AIDS policy adheres to biomedical and cultural models of HIV/AIDS, which failed to address the social context of women's HIV infection. We also saw that Kenyan women are disproportionately vulnerable to HIV/AIDS as a result of institutionalized gender inequality, which is a legacy of colonialism and is perpetuated today in and by the economic, education, legal, and healthcare systems in Kenya. So this model basically summarizes what I said and shows the relationship between colonialism, institutionalized gender inequality, and women's vulnerability to HIV infection. So what do we do about this? There are a number of existing gender-based approaches to HIV/AIDS out there, including gender-sensitive HIV prevention, the female empowerment approach, gender mainstreaming, and the transformational approach. I won't go into too much detail here, but I'll just say that the majority of these models fail to comprehensively address women's socioeconomic situations. The one that does get closest, though, is a transformational approach, which focuses on the social structure. So with that, I recommend an approach that is woman-centered and that is transformational in nature and that one formally recognizes that there is an identifiable, meaning that it didn't just come out of nowhere, an external, meaning that it is outside beyond people themselves, and common, meaning that it underlies a number of the structural factors that we see today, source to women's HIV infection risk, and an approach that, too, addresses the impact of colonialism and its legacies, mainly institutionalized gender inequality, on women's HIV infection risk. So I'm making a few more specific recommendations here by saying that this approach should promote women's economic rights through things such as increasing their access to credit, ensuring girls and young women's access to education by eliminating school fees, for example, revising existing legal codes and implementing laws that protect women's rights, such as allowing widows to inherit their husband's possessions, which is currently not allowed under Kenyan law, and decreasing access barriers to the healthcare system for women by allowing them to access health services without the permission of their husbands, for example. So lastly, I would like to acknowledge the following people for their expert advice and assistance with this project and presentation. And this is just a quote that I find particularly relevant to what I just discussed, and it kind of guided this project. And lastly, if you have any questions or would like a full copy of the report that goes into much more detail than I could ever go into here, you can feel free to email me and I will send one your way. Thank you.